You know, this morning, I just had, it was the spirit of this sermon, too. It was just kind of, I just felt like being a little bit unpresentable. Just, you know, a touch, anyway. Just a little bit, I don't know, raw, you know. This text, this psalm, is that way. It's a bit unpresentable. It's very raw. In fact, if you just heard somebody pray like this in public and you didn't know it was from the Bible, it was a psalm, you would think something is seriously wrong with them, probably. I mean, you might even be offended by them. Because this is somebody just shaking their fist at God. How long, O Lord? Will you forget me forever? How your face from me? If you heard somebody pray that way in public, would you want to like have the pastor get up and, you know, escort them off the platform and get them away from the mic? This is one of those raw texts. And interestingly, it's not isolated. Interestingly, it's not like some anomaly in the Bible. Oh, let's just brush that aside, brush under the carpet, because that's one of those unpresentable ones, kind of like we have unpresentable people in the church. Yeah. No, it's not an anomaly. In fact, like a third of all the Psalms are in the category of Psalms of lament. They are expressing intense anger or fear or just real grief and sadness, and coming before God. This isn't the only psalm that comes before him angry and angry at him. Walter Brueggemann is this world-renowned scholar on the Old Testament. He's written a lot on the Psalms too, and he talks about the costly loss of lament. The costly loss of lament. I didn't even have to read the article. I saw that and I'm like, man, yeah. Think of it this way. If a third of the Psalms are Psalms of lament, right, expressing kind of the unpresentable, the grisly, the grimy, the nasty stuff, right? How do we compare that to our hymn book? Pull out your, I'm not going to ask you to do this really, but if you were to pull out the blue hymn book, what percentage of our hymns are hymns of lament? Songs that convey this grief. I don't think it's a third. And even the ones that are in there, your typical church, how many of them would even be sung? I got the joy, 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 joy down in my... And I shouldn't be like... I mean, it's a wonderful song, I'm sorry, but that's what we focus on, and it's almost like, oh, that other stuff, hey, check it at the door, dude, okay? Put on the smiley face. When somebody asks you how you are, fine, blessed, yeah, doing great, thank you. I honestly, especially after this sermon, you know, I would look forward to the opportunity. I would love it, honestly, if somebody, you know, next week, next month, whatever, just, you know, hey, how you doing today? Not good. Angry at life, angry at myself. I'm angry at God. That's how I'm doing. You know, and I imagine most people, many of us, would probably be freaked out. I mean, I even wonder, in that moment, would I be ready to handle it? Because, you know, it just doesn't happen. Really. And this is the thing that grieves me oftentimes about church cultures, and I mean just church in with a big C, church culture, is too often we feel like we got to hide this stuff and keep it bottled and don't, you know, because it is the unpresentable stuff. And far from being somebody with weak faith or fragile faith or no faith at all, the person that would say that and still show up at church, I think, is someone with a very mature faith. The person who would come before God with a prayer like this, how long, O Lord? Will you forget me forever? How long are you going to hide your face from me? Actually, it's very likely a very mature faith. Their relationship with God has gotten to a level where they can be so brutally honest. It's gut-level communication. You and me, God. Here it comes. And today, I'm ticked. I think that is a very mature faith. I'm not alone. D.A. Carson says, and I love this, there's no attempt in Scripture to whitewash the anguish of God's people when they undergo suffering. They argue with God. They complain to God. They weep before God. Theirs is not a faith that leads to dry-eyed stoicism, but to a faith so robust it wrestles with God. Amen. I love the way Walter Brueggemann talks about Psalm 88, which, by the way, the language is almost, in some places, identical with Psalm 13. Psalm 88, 14 says, "Why, Lord, do you reject me and hide your face from me?" And Walter Brueggemann says of Psalm 88, "It's an embarrassment to conventional faith." No. Conventional faith is an embarrassment to biblical faith, would be the way we could put it. Conventional faith would want you to just put on a plastic smile over everything and respond to somebody with platitudes, you know. Somebody was telling me the other day that her grandson just went through a real harsh breakup and all this kind of stuff, and he said to her, "I'm getting really tired of people telling me, well, God's got a purpose for this." It's true, even biblical, but it's kind of like offering up a sponge full of vinegar while they're on the cross, you know. It's kind of like, thank you, but it's not really going to help. And by the way, vinegar doesn't really taste good. You can tell me it's got all kind of medicinal properties and everything, but really? Sometimes just in that raw moment, the best thing you can do as a friend, as a family member, the best thing you can do as a child of God trying to be a blessing is to just sit with them. The friends of Job did wonderfully for the first week, and then they blew it after that. But for the first week, says, if I remember right, I think it was a whole week, 7 days, they just sat with him and said nothing. Oh, man, that's the kind of friends that you want. I heard a story one time that somebody, you know, an untimely death of their spouse, and of all the people that came through, you know, and the visitation and greeting and everything, and many of the people offering the platitudes and, this woman said the person that meant to them most just sat down, sat beside her, and said nothing. Sometimes it's just a ministry of presence. Again, Walter Brueggemann, this guy says so much in so little few words. He says, the use of these psalms of darkness, he calls them psalms of darkness. The use of these psalms of darkness may be judged by the world to be acts of unfaith and failure. See, that's what we're afraid of coming to church, if we would be honest, is we're afraid somebody would think our faith is a failure. It's not. But for the trusting community, these psalms of darkness, their use is an act of bold faith, albeit a transformed faith. It is an act of bold faith on the one hand because it insists that the world must be experienced as it really is and not in some pretended way. On the other hand, it is bold because it insists that all such experiences of disorder are a proper subject for conversation with God. There's nothing out of bounds, nothing precluded or inappropriate. Everything properly belongs in this conversation of the heart. To withhold parts of life from that conversation is, in fact, to withhold part of life from the sovereignty of God. Oh, this I can't bring to church. No. Thus, these psalms make the important connection. Everything must be brought to speech, and everything brought to speech must be addressed to God, who is the final reference for all of life. That's what I love about this psalm. Let me tell you about my own personal experience with this psalm. I had a mentor a number of years back. In fact, Dewey, I think you mentioned him years back. He actually came here and did a presentation, Wesley Nelson. Yeah. And he was this wonderful covenant pastor wonderful man of God, and then went on to teach at the seminary. I think he taught evangelism. And my first encounter with Wesley, I was a college student at North Park College, and this guy was like in his 80s now, and he was preaching, and he just had us riveted. I mean, he in one moment had us in stitches. The guy was so funny. And the next moment, there was something profound he said that just caught us all. I mean, man, if I'm still alive, if I'm still preaching in my 80s, but let alone being able to preach it to the college crowd, this guy was wonderful, you know? So I had graduated from seminary, came back from a stint on the mission field, 2.5 years in Columbia, and was going through my ordination process, needed a mentor. They said, you need a mentor. I thought, well, I don't want to just ask some real busy pastor, you know, that doesn't have time for me to be a mentor. What about Wesley Nelson? And I had an adopted grandpa, that's a whole other story, Dr. Sebastian. Oh, man, what a wonderful man, who was living at Covenant Home right by North Park College. And so I had seen Wesley Nelson was there at the Covenant Home, he and his wife Margaret. And so I thought, wouldn't this be great? A great pastor, you know, had a great, 60 years plus or something like that in ministry. I want to ask him to be my mentor. And he agreed. And he was very gracious about that. But as we got together, all of a sudden his recent story came out, and he told me why they ended up in Covenant Home. And it was this. He said, this last summer, we had a wonderful summer. We had done this road trip. They had gone, I don't know, like 11,000 miles, something like that, driving around the United States. And, you know, they had living in their own home, had a dog, and, you know, everything was going just great. And she was still volunteering at Swedish Covenant Hospital, and they had some big gala event. And so he dropped her off at the door, as a good gentleman would. And so as she went through the doors, and it was a revolving door, some courier was rushing out. And he went through and pushed the door so hard, it hit her in the back. She went down to the ground, couldn't brace her fall, cracked her head on the ground. She was complaining of a severe headache. Finally, Wesley took her to the emergency room. They performed an emergency surgery. I don't know if it was a skull fracture or what. Saved her life. But after that, everything changed, and changed horrifically. And Wesley said, The doctors have shown us by the x-rays, on her brain there's just like this dark spot, this dark place. They can't even explain it. But here's the result. I mean, she still could function, walk and talk, had her memories and everything, but for some reason she was left in this perpetual state of high anxiety. She also had no sense of time, but he said, I can't even leave her for 5 minutes, but she just becomes wildly anxious. And then he said this, he looked at me, and he said, you know, the Bible tells us that God will give us peace, perfect peace, and there is no asterisk there. And it doesn't say, oh, unless you fall and hit your head. Here was this man of God, and he was spitting mad, and I didn't have an answer. I knew well enough. I'd already heard that story about the woman at the funeral. I knew, bite your tongue, don't even try. No platitudes here will count. Far from feeling like Wesley's faith was failing, I sensed, no, this is a mature faith. This is a wonderful man of God who could even express his anger with God. And I went home, you know, it just left this heaviness in my heart, and I was praying, and I was just praying for them. And when I came across this Psalm 13, it just fit. It just absolutely expressed it all. Your first two verses, and the thing about it, six verses. Everything in six verses, but it just takes what must have been, I'm imagining, maybe it was a day experience for the psalm writer, maybe it was a week, maybe it took years to get from verse 1 to verse 6. You don't know. And in our case, maybe it does take a day. Maybe it takes years to move from venting, but I mean just raw, just anger, bitterness. And then he moves That's first two verses. Then he moves through verse 3 and 4, just pleading for his life. And then there's just no transition. I put in your sermon notes transition, but there really is none in the psalm, but it's there. It's very easy to read in the psalm. Something massive happened of a transformation of heart, because all of a sudden, verses 5 and 6 are not just trust, but rejoicing. Wow, what happened here? And just quickly, we're going to go through it. Again, how long, O Lord? Will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? This is an accusation. This is saying, God, your word says that you will never leave me nor forsake me. But where are you then? In your silence. Is this silence? Or have you just forgotten me? Are you even here? Are you even listening? It's this kind of language. And this is not blasphemy. Please, this is not wrong. Actually, it's the prayer of a very mature believer. So moving from this venting, have you ever been wrestling with your thoughts? I mean, you can't even sleep. So he asks, how long must I wrestle with my thoughts? You ever been there where, I mean, it's just awful. And every blessed day have sorrow in my heart. How long will my enemy triumph over me? Who's the enemy here? Could be a person, could be a corporation. You know, in David's case, maybe it is. Egypt, Syria, maybe it's the enemy of his soul, Satan himself. How long will my enemy triumph over me? That's where I'm at. My enemy is just having at it. And it's like he's just got free rein to attack. And where are you? Then it moves into the pleading. Look on me and answer, O Lord my God. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. It's like darkness is closing. It's like the death shroud is already covering me. It's like they're moving the stone in front of the tomb, sealing me in. God, that's what it feels like. My enemy will say, I have overcome him. And my foes will rejoice when I fall. Ever felt like that? Like just everybody is against you? You know, in David, I mean, anybody that enters politics, it's like entering into the lion's den, but then the higher you rise, the more the lions increase. Literally, I mean, God bless the politicians. We should pray for them. And if you aren't a man or woman of faith, how could you even survive that without just being bitter and ugly? Maybe that's the case. There isn't enough faith in politics today, and so we have a lot of bitter and ugly politicians. We do need to pray for them. Whatever it is in your case, maybe it is the enemy of our soul and all of his legions, my foes, they'll rejoice when I fall. And so, God, do you even care? They will gain the victory. Where will your victory be? So it's the pleading for one's life, and even reminding God, your honor's at stake here. Then there's the transition, the transformation. I can only explain it by some other key texts. Psalm 30, 11. I should have underlined that. You turned my wailing into dancing. You removed my sackcloth and clothed me with joy. How does that come about? Here's the deal. Pete Scazzaro in his book was talking about the wall experience. It's a wall. You cannot go around it. The only way is through it. And he said everyone will experience this at least once in your lifetime. It's a wall, and it threatens to crush you. And in some cases, it does. It either crushes you and or it crushes your faith. Some people do not, you can't go around it, some people do not get through it, and it's crushing. I think in worst case scenarios, I don't even know if it's worse that your faith is crushed, or sometimes I think it warps the faith if we don't get through the wall. When I say that, it means I think this was what leads to some of that cold, either cynical or legalistic or pharisaical kind of faith. Get what I'm going at? You got to get through it. And he says the only way of getting through it is with grace. Underline that, grace. And he says, those who do, and he says, you can look at the writings of so many of the saints, and if you read what they wrote, so many of them, they went through the wall experience, and it was transformational. It changed their lives, because when they got through and got to the other end, they had this whole incredible experience with grace and a whole new understanding of grace. And out of that understanding, they could minister so much better with grace. This is the goal. How you get through it, is it going to take a day, a week, a month, years? In each case, it's different. But it's grace. It has to be grace. Any other thing could either warp your faith or absolutely crush it. Grace will get you through. Listen to what happened after the transformation. What a change. All of a sudden, in just a heart full of peace, but I trust in your unfailing love. Wait, verse 1, you were questioning his love. You were questioning, and that's the cool thing. He never questioned his existence. See, this is not words of an atheist here. This is words of a believer, still believing in God, but questioning God, questioning even his love. Look, all of a sudden, but I trust in your unfailing love. This is where grace will take you. This is where God wants to take you, where you will experience unfailing love because of that grace. Then he says, my heart rejoices in your salvation. There's not just confidence and peace and trust. There's joy in this heart now. I will sing to the Lord because he has been good to me. Wherever you're at in this process, maybe you're through the wall and all you have is peace and trust and rejoicing and singing for the Lord. God bless you. Maybe you're at the pleading stage. Dear God, my life is on the line here, and if you don't do something, I'm going to die. Maybe you're stuck in verses 1 and 2. Maybe you're in the venting and anger stage, and that's all right. Wherever you're at, this is what I love about the Psalms of Lament, how they minister, how they help me to articulate the gunk that the groans and the cries that I can't even put words to, and if I did, they'd probably be so mean and ugly. And they help me to pray this prayer. Wherever you're at, I think verses 5 and 6 can even be in the midst, when I'm in the midst of the anger. But I trust. I will. I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. These are declarations. This is my creed. This is now me flaunting it at my enemy. You will not have me. I am God's. This is the stand I take. I will trust. His love is unfailing. I will rejoice. I will sing. So as I was praying about Wesley and Margaret, feeling it for them, about every 5-6 years this happens to me, and all of a sudden music came to me, a melody came to me, and right then I didn't have to write anything down, the words were there, and I found this melody in my heart. And the coolest thing was, and I'll sing it for you, the coolest thing was I was able then to go and sing that to Margaret, you know. And at that point too, she was hospitalized, and shortly thereafter she did die. And as I sang it to her, the bitter words and the pleading and then the peaceful words, there was definitely a response from her. And Wesley noted it, and Wesley thanked me for it afterward. And it was just, yeah, I mean, for that alone, that opportunity to just be able to, from the heart, minister in that way with this Psalm of Lament, I mean, and that's why the Apostle Paul would say, this is what this whole sermon series is on, and we are to speak to one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. When it says psalms, don't just handpick those nice-sounding ones. Sometimes the most appropriate thing is the raw one. Let me finish by singing this. You know what, Josh? Is it possible? Can I sing with this mic and turn my other lapel one off? You got me? Okay.
How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, O Lord my God. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. My enemy will say, I have overcome him. And my foes, they will rejoice when I fall. Yes, my foes, they will rejoice when I fall. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good to me. Yes, I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good.